Start off right away. Why don't we establish a quorum? Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Here.
Berryhill here. Leyva.
Here.
Leyva here. Mitchell.
Here.
Mitchell here. Canella.
Here.
Canella here. De Leon.
Here.
De Leon here.
We establish a quorum. Mr. Vice Chair, welcome. Mr. Berryhill, again, one of our newest members, as well as Ms. Mitchell and Ms. Leyva. We're going to get right into it. Why don't we go to file item number one, and we're going to skip number two. We'll go to file item number one, then 3 through 7. We have a motion made. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Canella.
Aye.
Canella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Okay, motion passes in a 5-0 vote. That is, again, it's file item number 1, 3 through 7. We're going to file item number 2. These are the appointees of the governor. We're going to start off with Mr. Jim Evans, who is currently a member of the California Gambling Control Commission. We'll start off with Mr. Jim Evans. Mr. Evans, welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Be mindful, one thing, you cannot spin things here. There's no, you know, strict talking points or frames or narratives, you know. But we welcome you nonetheless.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and Senators.
Are those your keys, Mr. Evans, on the floor?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, those are the chair. Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. Appreciate your time, staff. Before we get going today, I just want to introduce my family.
Please, yes, definitely.
Right over here is my wife of 12 years, Lark Park, who many of you also know, have worked in Senate for a long time. My two children, the one on the far right is my oldest son, Jackson Park Evans. He's in fifth grade, turning 11. And my youngest son, Willie Park Evans, who's turning 9. And he's in third grade now.
Well, you know, Ms. Park, as well as Willie and Jackson, welcome. I think it's very exciting to see your father before this confirmation hearing. And those who were the spin and, you know, strict talking points that may have been lost. Obviously, Mr. Evans used to be, you know, in the comms unit, you know, with our governor, Mr. Brown. So welcome.
Thank you very much. And just a little trivia about Willie. He took his first steps, actually, in what is now Danny Alvarez's office.
Oh, okay.
On a long budget night. First thing I'd like to do is just thank the governor for his faith and confidence that I could do this job. Also Nancy McFadden, Mona Pascal, Joe Dillon, and the rest of the governor's staff for having the faith and confidence that I could do this job. Also want to say thank you to the staff of the Gambling Control Commission for welcoming me in open arms a year ago. They do excellent work in the service of Californians, and I want to make sure I recognize that here today. Also want to thank, I think there's members of the Bureau of Gambling Control here, and we're going to touch on our what we do, and I'd like to thank them for coming today.
You want to thank my predecessor, President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg.
Yes, I do.
Senator Mark DeSantis.
Yes. Senator Joe Don. The list goes on and on.
Your mom and dad.
I do want to thank the senators who met with me before in the days leading up to this meeting, and of course, the amazing Rules Committee staff and all you do to prepare the senator. So thank you very much. Brief introduction, I'm the chair of the Gambling Control Commission. We have about 35 people, including 5 commissioners. That includes 5 commissioners. Budget of about $6.5 million. And what we do is, to the best of our abilities, we help ensure the integrity of California gambling and card rooms. We do that through licensing. We license card room operators. We license financial interest holders, key employees, sometimes all the way down to the dealer in jurisdictions that don't have local gambling regulation. We promulgate regulations as the legislature provides, and we also act as administrative pass-through for funds from tribal governments. We work in concert, like I alluded to, with the Bureau of Gambling Control under the DOJ. They're our sister agency that provides the enforcement, the investigation and compliance aspects of gambling regulation in California. We work together in, I hope, a seamless way. We're trying. It's a thrilling job. I really enjoy it, and it's very important. And I'm thrilled to be before you today and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. We'll go to questions, answers, or commentaries from the members. Why don't we start off with Ms. Leyva?
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Good afternoon, Mr. Evans. It was very nice meeting with you,
Senator.
Learning more about the commission than I really even knew and what you do, so thank you for that.
Great.
Maybe you could go into a little detail here for us. When you came to the commission, you kind of felt that it was a broken place and what you're doing to fix that.
Great. Now, there was obviously a lot of news stories about things that happened in the commission before I got there, about conflict, about tension between staff and commissioners. What I found was a place that I think that where the morale was super low. And a lot of that had to do with just personality conflicts. So there were commissioners bickering with commissioners and staff bickering. There was a lot of bickering between the Gambling Control, the Bureau of Gambling Control and the Gambling Control Commission. And what I found about that, what I found that was interesting about that, it was never, almost never about the work. It was about personalities. And so when I got there, I tried to take the lessons I've learned from this place and the executive branch in terms of always keeping it about the work, keeping conflicts about the work, behaving and acting professionally, being open, but being somebody, I think, that every day when you get home and look yourself in the mirror, how did you comport yourself today? It's in the public interest. So I think we've improved, and I think the tenor that the tone that I set helped improve it, but the governor deserves credit. He appointed two people subsequent to me on the commission that you're going to hear in the next couple weeks or months, who are wise individuals, professional individuals, that have a lot of maturity. And we subsequently hired in November an executive director named Stacey Luna Baxter, who was the assistant bureau chief of the Bureau of Gambling Control, and she's doing an excellent job. And so I think we have a foundation there for growth and to have a commission that will, like I said, best serve the people of California.
Sounds like you guys are on the right track. Thank you. Keep up the good work. Thank you,
ma'am.
Mr. Pro Tem.
Thank you, Ms. Leyva. Mr. Berryhill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you for the good conversation the other day. I do appreciate it. I learned a lot about your commission also that day, and I'll be supporting you today. I have no problem at all.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berryhill. Mr. Vice Chair.
No questions.
Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just one quick question. According to the commission's website, it appears that the majority of the suppliers are not California-based. Have there been any discussions on the issues of diversity or increasing the use of California-based suppliers at the commission?
I think that's a noble goal and something we should aspire to. Most of the suppliers that we approve are for tribal gaming, mm-hmm. And the state doesn't have, unless in the compact process, doesn't have too much leverage into who is the supplier of the tribes.
Got it.
So we're talking about we're talking about slot machine operators,
right.
Shuffle decks, those
right.
things.
And are there and. Here's a real naive question. Are there California companies who produce those products?
I believe there are,
okay.
but there's probably not as prominent as, say, like somewhere like Australia, even Australia, like Aristocrat, other ones. So because of the compacting process and mm-hmm. tribal sovereignty, I think mm-hmm. it's a place that maybe could be encouraged, mm-hmm. but difficult to do from the commission.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah. No further questions for me, sir.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mitchell. Okay, we'll go to any supporters of Mr. Evans. Those in support of Mr. Evans, come on up. Those in support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Bob Giroux on behalf of the Hollywood Park Casino and Television Games Corporation, which airs horse racing throughout the country. We believe Mr. Evans to be not only competent, but fair, impartial, and a good addition to the Gaming Commission. Thank you very much.
Mr. Giroux. Any other folks in support of today's nominee, Mr. Evans, please come forward, yes.
Good afternoon, Yolanda Morrow with the Department of Justice Bureau of Gambling Control, and we strongly support Chairman Evans' confirmation.
Thank you very much. Next witness in support.
Good afternoon, Nate Davali, Bureau of Gambling Control, Compliance and Enforcement Section, Assistant Bureau Chief, and we are in strong support of Mr. Evans.
Thank you much. Next witness in support.
Good afternoon, Senator, honorable committee members. Wayne Quint, I'm the Bureau Chief for the Bureau of Gambling Control. I'm here on behalf of Attorney General Kamala D. Harris, the entire Department of Justice. We respectfully ask you to strongly support the governor's appointment. He's done a remarkable job. We're working better with the commission than I think we have in the last 4 years I've been chief, and I'd encourage you to support the appointment. Thank you
very much. Any other witnesses in support of today's nominee? Seeing no further witnesses or supporters, those in opposition. I'm seeing no opposition at all whatsoever. Mr. Evans, seems like you're very well qualified and very passionate about this issue, and you bring a strong knowledge base. And if not, you know, at the very least, you've demonstrated that you care deeply and that you'll only grow, you know, in your role as the chair of, of this specific commission. Can I entertain a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Cannella.
Aye.
Cannella, aye. DeLeon.
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
Willie and Jackson, as well as Lark, congratulations. Mr. Evans, congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senators.
Okay, colleagues, we're going to keep going with file item number two. We have BC. We have Mr. Keith, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Gillis?
It's just Keith, Gillis, yeah.
Gillis? Okay, Keith Gillis, as well as Mark Los Huertos. Mark Los Huertos, este bienvenido. Both are PhDs and members of the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. If there's anyone that you want to introduce, any loved ones, friends, please do so. And then what we'll do is we'll go to your statement, and we'll go to questions and answers. How's that work?
I don't have anyone here with me, but that's my name is Mark Los Huertos. I'm a biochemist. I'm a faculty member at Pomona College.
Claremont Colleges?
The Claremont Colleges.
Pitzer, you know, Sage N.
Yes.
We work together on our football team. Yes. Right? Pomona Pitzer, you know, at the Claremont Colleges. Just saying. You know,
I have been only a member of the board for a few months and just starting to learn about all the activities that the board works on. And one of the areas that I will say that I'm particularly committed to is the role of how to balance the forestry practices and healthy forests and carbon sequestration, and AB 32 is something that I'm very interested in pursuing on the with the work there. So I have a whole speech here, but I can't remember any of it, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you much, Mr. Los Huertos. Mr. Gillis.
Hi. Yes, I've been very honored to be allowed to serve on the board for several years now. It's a sort of fulfillment to my mind of the service obligation that comes with being a faculty member in a land-grant university and in the state's agricultural experiment station in particular. Felt like a much better place to use my talents at this late point in my career than writing a few more papers for journals. And I've tried very hard to have the board be a place where we talk about very tough things in a respectful and open environment where everyone's voice gets heard. And they feel they had their chance to influence policy, and where the board is actually acting on the critical issues of the day, issues like the drought mortality, about making it financially viable to manage your forests in the state, trying to balance environmental concerns with our need for rural economic development, consistent with my career having focused on markets for forest products, rural economic development, and fire protection issues. So I've enjoyed serving, and I hope my service was deemed up to par. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gillis. Why don't we go to questions and answers from the members? We start with Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm sorry that our schedules did not permit us the opportunity to meet beforehand, but in talking to my staff, I'm clear that you had a very comprehensive meeting with Rules Committee staff, and I have no questions, sir, of either candidate. I'll be supportive today.
Okay, thank you very much. Why don't we go to our Vice Chair,
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. So we just visited, and I appreciated the visit. I'm going to ask a couple of questions just for the other folks that may be watching or listening. But so on the SRA fees that we talked about, the board has now has the authority to select if the SRA fee is to be adjusted in a given year. What factors are considered in making that determination?
I think the main factor, to my mind, was that the program is currently actually spending down an accumulated fund balance, so that there was no financial argument necessitating triggering the increase at this point in time.
Okay. So last year, you did not increase the fee.
Correct.
What, at what point do you need to decide whether you're going to increase the fee this year, and what is the process that would be used if there is a decision to increase the fee?
We would put this through our process like any other rulemaking activity, where there would be public notice, there would be an opportunity for input from anyone that felt they had an argument for or against our exercising the option to do the cost adjustment.
So with so many people affected, do you send out a notice to all the folks that pay the SRA fee, or how is it noticed and to get the public input?
Well, that's an interesting question. The board's primary communication is through its website, which I think we've made some good steps in the last year to improve the utility of that. Our notice of where discussions like that take place is sometimes reinforced by echoing that on other websites. So, for instance, CAL FIRE has an SRA, Fire Prevention Benefit Fee webpage, which many people might land on before us, and that be a place where you'd echo that the fees adjustment was under reconsideration, because people would be more likely perhaps to see it there, depending upon how their search engine worked.
Okay, so no.
But a direct to homeowners is an interesting. There is no direct notice to homeowners that there is this annual potential for reevaluation. It's a very good point.
Well, and then you may want to consider it just because it's been a pretty contentious fee in that way.
It could easily be incorporated in the notices themselves.
Great. And then on the timber harvesting plan, what changes could be made to the THP process to make it less costly, in your opinion?
I think reducing the costs is critical. Everyone on the board is very interested in the efficiency with which we discharge these responsibilities. Trying to hold the agency accountable for experiments where you increase the staffing in what appear to be the rub points. There's been augmentations in staffing for the fish and wildlife component of review of THPs recently. Can that reduce delay? Coming up with alternative mechanisms to the timber harvest plan, like the working forest management plan that we're working on, that would extend sort of security of operations, where rather than a THP, you'd file a notice of operations under the lifetime of the plan. That could also effectively dramatically reduce the costs of management. Melissa Hortus, if you had anything you wanted to add?
Based on experiences I've had on the Central Coast, that there's options that I've seen work with the resource conservation districts, where they've been a sort of a one-stop shop for permits, and that's been a very successful program, but it's usually required a pretty substantial non-NGO investment to get that off the ground and rolling. But I think that's something that I would be really interested in pursuing, especially for small landowners that don't have the capital to start file these. Basically, can be quite expensive for very small landowners.
And I think there's also, we have an effort underway called the Effectiveness Monitoring Committee, which is a multi-agency action. And so the more fundamental response is the regulation needed or is it effective? If it's neither needed nor effective, then obviously the part of the answer could be that you would actually reduce the regulatory complexity.
Great, thank you. So, you know, if you drive up in the forest, you see lots of dead trees, and I can't differentiate, you know, public lands and private lands, but it's clearly a problem all over the forest. How is it possible to thin the forest, to get rid of those dead trees without a feasible biomass program to deal with those, in your opinion?
In my personal opinion, no. I think we have to have a viable biomass sector that fits in well with our other energy goals for the state. But it's just too much material, and the transition requires us to have something to do with all that material.
Yeah, okay.
And I would just add, it's largely outside of Board of Forestry's purview.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Outside of the Board of Forestry's purview.
Biomass?
Where to put that and how
well,
to process
maybe,
that.
But if you're talking about thinning, then obviously you're both intelligent individuals, so you probably think about what happens after you thin the forest.
Exactly.
And it sounds like you're saying
We can make it, and we have made it easier to thin the forest. It's just that's where our authority ends.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand, but folks kind of talk to each other, and if they understand the experts are saying, look, we need biomass in order to deal with these trees, then hopefully other departments will listen.
We don't have a regulatory role, but we do have an informational role, and a variety of us do have a role in kind of the information which would help science-based policy that could have obvious benefits for going forward here.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Berryhill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank both of you for coming to my office. We had a very good conversation about tree mortality, about CAL FIRE, about SRA fees. Mr. Cannell was very thorough and stole all my questions. So, I'd just like you to, maybe both of you to talk a little bit, of course, with the tree mortalities and the forest fires that we've had the last few years, only 3.6% of CAL FIRE's budget was allocated for resource management. We spend an awful lot of money on fire suppression. I'm just wondering if moving forward, there's any way that we could allow CAL FIRE to do a little bit more on, put more resources into forest management. If we don't thin those forests out, we're looking at, a biblical forest season this year. So any thoughts about allocations of monies for both of those?
I'll start. I think as controversial as the fire prevention benefit fee has been, it solved one of the problems nationwide with respect to doing good forest management, which is it's putting a stable funding source behind the kinds of activities programmatically that you're saying we need to be doing these, we need to be doing this at a much higher scale, and we need to do them over a very long time period if we're going to have a landscape that's really a resilient landscape. And so we are investing. We're so far behind the curve from years of not investing that it will take a long time to actually tip the balance. But this last year, when the U.S. Forest Service's budget went over 50% to fire suppression, that was a fair indication of the problem we're facing nationally, where for a variety of reasons that I won't go into here, even though I'm an economist and I love them, the costs of fire suppression are going to continue to go up under any realistic scenario, particularly so in the Western U.S. And that's causing us to drop spending programmatically on things like vegetation management that would actually have a feedback loop into those suppression expenditures. And so I'm very supportive of moving forward with both the funding that we put in place on fire prevention and especially vegetation management. And that's part of the reason why the board has worked so hard over the last couple of years trying to move forward a programmatic environmental impact report to reduce the project level costs of vegetation management in the 31 million acres of state responsibility area.
I'm new enough on the board that I couldn't really answer the question in a very robust way, but I want to say that, defensible space, the education and the SRA grants to promote that have been, I think, are a key part of that. The role that we have actually redefined what healthy forests look like now in the West is, I think, a huge step in how we change how we manage our forests. And practically how to implement those on a reasonable time scale, I'm hoping to learn quickly how we can do that better.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Mr. Cannella was mentioning about these biomass plants. We've got 9 of them in Northern California that contracts are coming due this August, and or July, I guess. And if we don't keep those things going, those are about our only tool left in the shed to get rid of some of all these dead trees that need to be taken out. So as you guys move forward, this is critical. If we don't do something, we're going to have a carbon problem that is biblical as we move into this next year. Right. So keep that in mind as you move forward, and I'm not going to have any problem with confirming either one of you today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berryhill. Ms. Leyva.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I, too, apologize that I didn't have time to meet with you. And I'm going to follow in Senator Berryhill's vein of questioning. I was shocked to learn that there were 29 million dead trees, either to the drought or with the bark beetles. Thank you. So I don't know that there's a lot we can do about watering the trees with the drought. What can we do about the beetles to help them get rid of them so that they don't kill the trees?
Well, you're an ecologist. You want to take this one? I can do it, but you're an ecologist. Why don't you give it a shot?
You finish it. I haven't studied bark beetles in a long time. Bark beetles are native, and they're part of a natural process of old drought-stressed or stressed trees. And so that's been sort of on the long view. There have been outbreaks of bark beetles in the past. From what I have read, the thinning or lower stand density will allow higher health of trees, therefore less water stress, mm-hmm. therefore better able to resist bark beetle infestations. So as you can guess, fire suppression, high density of trees, low water years, and increase in bark beetle infestation is sort of the perfect sequence of events that have led to a major sort of loss of trees due to bark beetles and drought. So I think what we're seeing is not just an extraordinary drought, but the combination of fire suppression for the last 100 years that's sort of combined to make probably hopefully the worst forest health now, and we're going to be figuring out how to do this better from now on.
Yeah.
All right.
One
Sounds
thing
good.
To add, though, and you're right. I mean, if we're in a more resilient landscape with lower stocking of trees, there'll be better soil moisture availability, even under whatever the rainfall regime that you're in is, and that improves the tree's ability to pitch out the beetles. However, the beetles in the Central Sierra are getting most of the press. The board was just in San Diego on what I would view as big a problem, which are invasive beetles, which are causing mortality in a landscape level, that in particular the gold-spotted oak borer and the polyphagous shothole borer, which is actually an Asian pest. We were standing in a stunning and very disturbing landscape on the Tijuana River just last Wednesday, where we were looking at every willow tree, in essence, every adult willow tree, in the riverbed of the Tijuana River was dead. And this has incredible implications for the biodiversity in these drier landscapes where the riparian areas are the refuge for a great, great portion of the biodiversity. Has great implications with the golden spotted oak borer for loss of shade trees, which can transform a park, which is a wonderful part of people's connection with nature and the outdoors, into a hillside that, do you really want to go on that hillside and put up a pop-up tent? Is that recreation? So these things can cause 90% mortality or end up. They're very serious. And so the board also has a role in these pathogens, which are not drought-related.
Okay, very good. I did not realize that the beetle actually sounds like it thrives in the dry trees. So it's the moisture that keeps
the bark beetles.
The bark beetles that allows the tree to shed them, if you will, if it's more moist. Okay. Well, thank you for being on top of it. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem.
Thank you, Ms. Leyva. Gentlemen, Mr. Los Huertos, as well as Mr. Gillis, are both academics, PhDs at Cal and Pomona Claremont colleges, respectively. So we have the issue, obviously, of climate change. We have the issue of a historic drought. Now we're in our fifth year of a historic drought. with climate change, and we have over 20 million dead trees, and then we have, you know, the continued risk of more forest fires, and it seems like today's forest fires are meaner.
They are.
They last longer, and they surely cost us a lot of money from our general fund, unnecessarily, that we could spend otherwise, whether it's in higher education or elsewhere. It damages the environment and damages people's livelihoods, you know, who live in and around forests, whether it's the Sierras or down south or in Central California. So how do we reduce the risk of these, what is to be projected is more fires in the near future, forest fires specifically, by balancing the ecological needs of our environment and our current ecosystem?
Okay.
Well, I can say an example we saw last week with when the board went on the field trip to San Diego was a pretty impressive collaboration between Cal Fire and the Forest Service to build fire breaks in a mixed landscape with Wildland Interface something?
Wildland Urban Interface.
Yeah, I'm getting used to the initials here. And so with more and more development in these wildlands, we're having to be way more proactive around building fire breaks or investing in fire protection around habitat structures. So I think seeing those collaborations across the state and federal agencies is going to be a key component. And at least I was very impressed last week by seeing this collaboration. And because so much of the state is federal forest land, we're going to have to really come to grips with an improved cooperative management plan with the Forest Service. And the Forest Service, we have a liaison to the Board of Forestry that comes and has been working with us. And I've been told that relationship is improving every year.
What do you mean by improved when you say improved? So it's not working?
Coordination.
And if it's not working, why is it not working?
I heard her once so far, and she said that we've had unprecedented collaboration in the last few years than we've had in the past.
I think the Drought Mortality Task Force has really been a forum where interagency cooperation, state and federal, but also with local government, has really, everybody's on the same page. There's less, it feels like less turf and more of a recognition of a common threat. And so I think that's really a source of a lot of improved interactions between these agencies, because the problem is so obvious and apparent. And the failure to take place or to take care of it is so apparent.
Let me throw out this open-ended question with regards to the tens of millions of trees that are either dead or dying, and some of it's due to what's indigenous and organic to California, the bark beetle. Other, it's the drought. Are these dead trees a reflection? My colleague here, Mr. Berryhill, used the word biblical, you know, in terms of what's before us, in terms of something that's catastrophic, if you will, whether it's biblical, you know, cataclysmic, you know. Are dead trees are today's canary in the coal mine when it comes to carbon emissions and climate change?
I think this is a great question. I think we go through mortality events, and so you always have to separate out, you know, episodes. The very first hearings on climate change,
and
were taking place in D.C. Yeah. when they were having rolling brownouts, and the scientists had to say, the brownout we're experiencing is not climate change, right? You have brownouts, but. I think more on point is to say everything that we would say we would expect under a climate change scenario will exacerbate the problems we're experiencing with the weather, which we are experiencing now, which is not projected weather. And that says that the landscape that we've created through our management activities in areas is not well suited either to the ecology of a kind of a disruption ecology where fire comes in and it's a big event, But it's not well suited to the purposes or goals people have for the landscape either. People want to live in these landscapes, and our current vegetation matrix and our current total level of prevention activity to protect people and infrastructure isn't making, it's not doing the job under the current scenario, and it will fall behind under any kind of a climate change scenario. So you don't actually have to accept climate change as inevitable in order to say the current situation is dysfunctional. And it's dysfunctional in ways that we haven't even touched yet, like things like the Valley Fire. The households that are being affected by this are some of the least resilient households in our society. Loss of household assets, of having, you know, a fire burn through a low-income area that's in a rural area, you know, where you're living in, is tremendous what this does to the strain it puts on our social safety net, because you're affecting the least resilient households. So there's a lot of cost beyond that. We are doing things, and we're doing the right things. We're more rigorously enforcing the vegetation management around homes. Every study we've ever done in this wildland-urban interface says rigorous application of vegetation management and building codes when you're putting in new buildings, not going back and making people rebuild a building other than the one they had, it pays off massively. Concentrating your vegetation management activities at first, logically, in the transitions between the wildland and where the human infrastructure is, that also pays off. But ultimately, we need to be ambitious enough that we do something about the landscape beyond just the infrastructure or the borders. So it's a very tall order, but you can work at it at both ends. You can work at it in the impact of the built environment and on people, and you can work at it at the landscape level, and you can look at the transitions between the two. But they're different policies to address those different issues.
So, but if you do what you just articulated, does climate change make this worse?
Yes, for California.
For California.
Not for everywhere, but for California. And I was actually involved. I wrote one of the white papers on the effect on initial attack on fire that were the underlying scientific basis for AB 32. And yes, especially in moisture-limited environment like the Sierra Nevada, or in chaparral and grassland environments, where the climate change scenarios mm-hmm. change the number of extreme fire weather events, mm-hmm. You would logically, under any analysis I've seen done, it does look worse. And so if it's bad now, it could be worse if any of those projected scenarios pan out.
So obviously not to politicize what comes first, the chicken or egg, and that's why I want to be very careful. I'm not a scientist, so I can't say with any sense of authority, any degree of authority that climate change has created the environment that we have today with regards to the wildfires. You know, I can't say that. I don't know that, nor am I asking you that. Yeah. I want to be very clear. I'm not asking you that. Yeah. But it's more so on the back end. Does it compound the current situation? And from what I'm hearing,
absolutely.
From you, the answer is yes.
I don't know, Mark.
Mr. Los Huertos.
Yes. Yep. Brevity is the, I want to be brief, but yeah, absolutely correct. Yes.
Okay. All right.
We're trying hard not to speak in 50-minute intervals.
No. That's good. That's okay. That's quite good. Any other questions or commentaries from the members? I'm seeing none. So I want to bring up those who are in support of these two nominees, or either one. Those who are in support of both or either, please come on up. Identify yourself and share your thoughts, and then we'll move on from there.
Kirsten Kolpicki with CalForest. We're in support of both nominees today. We have a long history with Dr. Gillis. Our members very appreciate his work on the board. And while our experience is less extensive with Dr. Los Huertos, we very much appreciate the governor's efforts to put people with scientific backgrounds and their experience on the board.
Thank you. Next witness in support, Mr. McKaylee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, Chris McKalia on behalf of the Humboldt and Redwood, Mendocino Redwood Company, sorry. We have the similar experience with Mr. Gillis, a lot of work with him, and appreciate his openness and work. And we admire the background of Mr. Los Huertos, but don't have direct experience with him just yet. But we do encourage your confirmation of both appointees. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other folks in support of both nominees or either nominee? Seeing none, anyone in opposition? I am seeing none. Let me just ask one last question before we actually get to a vote. The Forest Carbon Plan, what is the board's role with the Forest Carbon Plan?
Member Andre and I have been taking point on the Forest Carbon Plan so far. I think I would like Member Andre to get very involved in that because I think as well he has a tremendous skill set to add to that role. Our biggest role so far has been in advocating for accounting standards for carbon, which we feel will properly quantify the potential for forest products, whether that's forest products in use as a sequestration avenue or forest products as a substitution effect for materials which have a much higher carbon footprint, like a steel beam, that those issues are worked into the carbon plan because that's the standard internationally for accounting for the effects of carbon as it relates to the forestry sector. And the other thing is just making sure that all of the different interests, and they are complex with very different, I think, organic legislation, giving them their missions, look at the appropriateness of different activities that could, in the long run, reduce emissions from wildfire. It's a very tricky issue to deal with the accounting there, but I feel like the board has participated very actively and that the actions, the discussions that have taken place in trying to develop the plan recognize these difficulties and that the board input has been useful in trying to reach a plan that really holds up as a science-informed policy.
Okay, all right, okay, with that,
can
Mr. Berryhill.
Just a real quick, kind of a yes or no answer. In the Lake, both the Lake and Butte fires, we lost a lot of homes. There's a lot of angst out there on, there was a Brian Dolly bill that exempted anybody that had lost their home for paying that SRA fee for 2 years. That is going to continue.
I think putting that into the administration of the fee was a no-brainer, and I can't see it ever coming out.
Great, thank you.
Okay, with that, we've had those who are in support. We have no opposition of Mr. Gillis as well as Mr. Los Huertos. Do we have a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill. Aye. Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Canella.
Aye.
Canella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Dr. Gillis and Dr. Los Huertos, congratulations. You both passed on a 5-0 vote. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, colleagues, what we're going to do is we're going to go into an executive session. So if I could get everyone to please just exit. Ms. Manning will be sharing a few pearls of wisdom and knowledge with us.